This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and this weekend, of course, we celebrate this nation and its ideals. At the core of those ideals is the right to vote. It is the very heart of a democracy, a right that has been denied to many, explicitly or in more hidden ways, at different times since the very founding of the United States. 2020 is the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, and a century is just about how long it took for women to earn that right. In most of our history classes, there's a paragraph or two about women being given the right to vote, as if it were fast and easy. In truth, it was a long, difficult, even occasionally violent journey. The people fighting for the right were considered radicals. They were pariahs. A new film from American Experience called The Vote explores the women's suffrage movement. The two-part series airs Monday and Tuesday, July 6th and 7th at 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain on Prairie Public. Filmmaker Michelle Ferrari directed the film series for American Experience. Roughly the first 6 decades of the fight were characterized by what most historians would call a moderate, even polite, approach. The Vote focuses on the last decade, when a younger generation gets fed up being ignored. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's absolutely my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So it's a very complex time in history. We're talking a nearly a century-long effort for women's suffrage. And so I'm curious, besides the 100-year anniversary, of course that is 2020, why did you want to tell this story right now?
You know, The film actually came to me. I have a long relationship with the PBS series American Experience. Most of my career has unfolded within the confines of that series. And they were, you know, kicking around ideas because of the centennial of the 19th Amendment, and they brought the subject to me. I will say that I was very excited to work on it because I didn't really know anything about the suffrage movement. And to put that in some kind of context, I will tell you that I majored in American history in college, and I have a graduate degree in American history. And I still didn't know anything about the women's suffrage movement. I think that has something to do with my age. Probably in the years when I was studying, you would have had to have been a women's studies major to have learned about the women's suffrage movement. But I figured, given my background in history, that I wasn't alone in not knowing anything. And that is always an exciting prospect for me to be delving into a subject that people don't know a lot about.
Yeah, I only knew a couple of the names, and then it became clear very quickly that I didn't know anything about the women's suffrage movement either.
I think it typically gets reduced to about a paragraph, right? And that paragraph begins in 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York, and it ends in 1920 with American women being given or granted the right to vote. And, you know, that paragraph obscures a very rich and complex, as you said, 72-year battle, and really puts into shadow one of the most sustained and successful political mobilizations in American history.
Well, yeah, when you use that verb, we're given. So first of all, it's entirely passive on the part of the women. We act as though this was something so first of all, white men had the right to vote, and women had to convince the men to let them vote. And I'm kind of thinking, well, we don't ask cats what the rights of mice should be, but the whole context of we're given the right to vote, we're granted, it's almost as if they just, you know, said, oh, please, dear, and batted their eyes once, you know, and then that was it.
It was bestowed upon them by an enlightened populace. But that was not the case at all. I mean, I think one of the things that was most surprising to me was the fierce opposition that existed right up until the very bitter end. I mean, many of the battles for suffrage at the state level and at the federal level, they passed by a vote or two.
Right.
So it's not as though there was a broad political mandate to give women the right to vote. Not at all.
Well, let's talk about just a little bit setting up before the Seneca Falls Convention. What was life like for women, you know, specifically the women in the documentary, rights-wise? We're talking they couldn't sign contracts if they were even allowed to have a job or forced to have a job. Often the paycheck went straight to the husbands. It was automatic that they'd lose custody in the case of a divorce.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's important to note that we're talking about free white women here. But they were, when they were married, absorbed into the person of their husband. They had no legal existence outside of their husband. As Ellen Du Bois, a historian, notes in our film, that would be fine if there were unmarried women, but most adult women were married. In the early 19th century.
One thing that really struck me in the vote is that the movement seemed like it was starting out right where what we would call today fourth wave feminism seems to just now be getting intersectional, and at least when it comes to racial relationships and including women more than just educated, white, married women as part of women's rights. But they ended up with sort of a loose relationship with the importance of factoring in race when it comes to the expansion of rights. So I know this is a very complex history, but can you sort of navigate us through, specific to race, the relationship between women's rights and the rights of freed slaves and the rights of blacks at that time, and that relationship? And I'm thinking, you know, right away, Frederick Douglass, a prominent black male activist, and Susan B. Anthony, a prominent educated white woman, and they both understood that they didn't have the same rights as the white men in this country. And they weren't always seeing this from the same perspective.
White women activists, women's rights activists in the years around the Civil War and at the beginning of Reconstruction, there was a recognition that the status of women and African Americans bore some resemblance to one another. And Frederick Douglass was probably the first man to publicly support women's suffrage in 1848, and, you know, put an editorial on the front page of his paper supporting women's demand for the vote. That alliance grows in the aftermath of the Civil War, and white women, white abolitionists are instrumental in lobbying Congress to pass the Reconstruction Amendments, the 15th Amendment giving black men the right to vote. However, they wanted the 15th Amendment to extend the franchise to women as well. And there was an argument in the aftermath, after the 15th Amendment had been crafted, there was an argument within this coalition about whether or not to accept the 15th Amendment. And, one wing of the coalition argues that it must be accepted and that it's important for black men to have the vote, even if women aren't going to get it at the same time. And another faction under Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were absolutely crushed by that decision. And that causes a splintering of the movement that remains really for decades to come.
Well, it's really interesting throughout the course of the documentary, and it's just shy of 4 hours in length, that you talk about historians talk about the role of what's seen as the moderate and what's seen as the radical factions. Again, a very complicated question to narrow down in just a few minutes. But as you were putting this together, how do you classify those two different factions, and how did they work together, and how did they, when were they at odds?
I should say that, you know, although the 4 hours does nod to the broad sweep of the movement, the full 72 years, we focus primarily on the last decade.
Yes.
We pick up the story really in 1909. And in that last decade, the movement became more militant overall. There was definitely a mounting impatience on the part of women, and there was also increasing momentum for a variety of reasons. And so in the film, we focus on, you know, these two wings, the more moderate wing, the National American Woman Suffrage Association, which was the largest suffrage organization in the country. It was a federated organization with state chapters. And they sort of pursued a more traditional path of lobbying politicians, both at the state and the federal level, letter writing campaigns, petitions, that sort of thing. They were, by 1909, also having parades, which, you know, 20 years earlier would have been unthinkable, but by 1909, their impatience was mounting also. And then there was the National Woman's Party under Alice Paul. And Alice Paul was in the third generation of feminists, of first wave feminist. She was younger. She had spent time in England and had kind of come up as a suffragist at the knee of Emmeline Pankhurst and her daughters, who were the leaders of the kind of militant suffragist organization in Britain, and they were known as suffragettes. So Alice Paul demonstrates with them. She goes on marches with them. She gets arrested. She's jailed. She declares herself a political prisoner, which is part of their tactics. When she does not receive that status, she goes on a hunger strike. She's force-fed in prison. When she finally comes back to the United States, she's pretty sure that this is going to be her life's work, and she brings all these tactics back with her. The British movement goes on to become increasingly militant and radical, and there's quite a lot of violence. And Alice Paul, I think, had a sense that the violent tactics would never quite work here, but she did bring all the tactics of civil disobedience into the movement. And there was a lot of disagreement between these two wings, between the National American Woman Suffrage Association and the National Woman's Party, over the best way to proceed. And they, you know, they each kind of go their own way. Historians differ as to, you know, which faction had more influence. The series argues that they were both necessary, and I really believe that to be true. I think if you look at most political movements, successful political movements in the United States, there's always an inside and an outside game being played, and the two methods wind up working really well together.
We say this all the time when we look at the men of history, the complicated, and I'm using air quotes here, and things like Thomas Jefferson, and almost undoubtedly was raping his slaves. And some would say it's consensual, but I mean, when you look at the power structure there, rape seems the more appropriate word. Or we excuse like Theodore Roosevelt's attitude of the indigenous peoples. And we use this phrase, he was a man of his time. And already within the context of teaching history, to me, that seems like a type of luxury. As we're looking at the early suffragists, and I'm thinking, like we already mentioned, the early dismissal of Black activists, the incorporation of sort of the militant tactics, are they viewed as women of their time?
Well, I mean, I think, although there's something cloying about the phrase, I agree, everyone is a product of their time. to a certain extent, which is to say that, you know, racism was, as Martha Jones says in the series, you know, a political fact and a political strategy, particularly around the turn of the century, when we were still very much resolving the questions and controversies raised by the Civil War. And I think, you know, there's something a little bit false about expecting white American women to have radically different attitudes than their male counterparts. I do think, you know, many white suffragists, not all by any means, but many white suffragists did bow to those realities and did accommodate racism if they thought it would enhance their agenda. And they were willing to sideline African-American suffragists, sideline Black women at the polls if it meant that they were going to get the vote. Again, not all of them, but some of them.
You know, it's interesting to me when we're talking about racial relationships within this country, we put it in Black and white, and then there's just no mention of the people who were here before the colonizers and before the slaves were brought in, and then other groups of people that were also brought here, oftentimes in just a different kind of slavery. Do we know what the indigenous experience was at this time, what it was like for Asian people in this country, what it's like for other disenfranchised groups that don't even get a mention when we talk about race relations in this country?
Right. I mean, I will say that those other groups, and this is true for African Americans as well, you know, their experiences within these movements are not well documented. So it's much more difficult to pull out the narrative of their experiences. I mean, certainly, you know, Native Americans, although this is not in our series, it was sort of outside of the purview of our period, but Native Americans were, for many early women's rights activists, inspirations, because they were, their societies were more matriarchal. You know, early suffragists like Lucretia Mott observed the Native American societies around them and saw that women had rights within their societies that American women did not, white American women did not. By the time we get to the period that the series covers, the vote covers, Native Americans are largely confined on reservations, and they are not considered citizens of the United States. So they're not part of the story at all from the perspective of the federal government. There is documentation and a certain amount of evidence about Asian women, particularly Chinese women, participating in the suffrage movement on the West Coast, in Washington State, in California, and Latino women in California. So we know that they're there, but they're frequently named at best. Hmm.
Some of the opposition to women getting suffrage at all, I was surprised to learn, came from other women. And I'm thinking specifically of Annie Nathan Meyer, the founder of Barnard College. So you think, at least in 2020, you know, that someone who would have been a fierce advocate for women's education, I was surprised to learn that she was a prominent anti-suffragist.
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, the anti-suffragists are very, very interesting. Because, as you just said, you know, why would a woman be against having political rights? And I think, you know, for some of them, it was a religious matter. Mm-hmm. But for the vast majority of them, I think it had to do with the fact that they believed that women changed society differently, mm-hmm. That they had a sort of indirect role to play by influencing the males in their sphere, and that by forcing them to vote, you would be undermining their traditional role, which, you know, for many of these women, they had a lot of class and racial privilege. They felt that they could get what they wanted without going to the polls. And as Annie Nathan-Meyer pointed out, you know, much of the gains for women that took place between the mid-19th century and the early 20th century had been made without the vote.
Hmm. Well, and voting itself was not, you know, it didn't look like it was a place where I would want to be even now. And I'm thinking back, you know, 100 years or more, these very rowdy saloons that, I mean, just the atmosphere of voting itself was not in a space that was very female friendly.
Absolutely not. No, I mean, the polls were in tobacco shops and saloons, in barber shops. It was raucous. It was, and turnout was very high, and people were drunk at the polls. This was not supposed to be a sphere in which women were mingling. For women of a certain class in particular, it was anathema to think of setting foot in that scene.
Well, because a lot of the women's suffrage movement is also tied into the temperance movement. And just for a little bit of context here, early in the women's suffragist movement, in the women's suffrage movement, alcohol was very free-flowing for men and not all men, of course, but oftentimes they'd come home after a paycheck, they would go and drink away the entire paycheck and then go home and possibly beat the wives and children and then leave the wives with almost no money to get food and actually do anything within that domestic sphere at all. But then people who were being convinced to give women the right to vote, they had this fear that they were going to lose the right to drink as well.
Right. Yeah, there was a fair bit of overlap between the suffrage movement and the temperance movement. Susan B. Anthony was a leader of both, just as by way of example. And the Women's Christian Temperance Union actually supported the right to vote for women because they regarded the vote as they put it, a weapon for home protection. So there was a lot of fear, particularly among, you know, the liquor industry, within the liquor industry, that if women got the right to vote, they would vote for prohibition. And there was a lot of, there were many, many attempts to, on the part of the liquor industry, to undermine the movement for suffrage. So if a referendum were coming up in a given state, the liquor industry would, you know, offer people free beer if they would vote against the referendum. But this was not only true of the liquor industry, it was true of any industry that was profiting from practices that women might upend. So, you know, child labor, unequal wages in the garment industry or dangerous working conditions. All of these industries were fearful of the way women would vote. And, you know, it turns out that they don't actually vote in a block any more than men do. It was a somewhat misguided fear, but it was nevertheless responsible for a lot of opposition to women's suffrage.
Per usual, when it comes to historical activity and when it comes to dramatic sort of sea change, the mass media always plays a pivotal role. And early on, there are some really terrible cartoons depicting suffragists as, you know, ugly old hags who just weren't pretty enough to get a husband, and they're going to, you know, be, like you said, taking away their men's ability to just go out and have a drink after a hard week of work. But then as the movement finally does start to pick up some steam and move forward, the role of the mass media is, after women have understood, there's sort of a PR element to here, and especially in World War One. When I think there's a quote in the film that's something like, when men are off war and women go to work. So can you talk about when women first understood that role of the mass media and the kinds of stories about women going to work in the fields and providing all the food, for example, for the men, for the soldiers?
Yeah, I mean, certainly by the 19-teens, there is an awareness that they need to market their cause. They need to brand it. They need to get themselves in the newspaper so that people are talking about suffrage, as Harriet Stanton Blatch, Elizabeth Cady Stanton's daughter, says, you know, so people are talking about it whether they agree or disagree. But it becomes part of the national conversation. And during World War I, when women were slipping in to replace men who had gone off to war and were doing, you know, factory work and working in industries, the National American Woman Suffrage Association ran a very, very sophisticated PR campaign, basically reporting on all the things that women were doing for the war effort, selling Liberty bonds, raising, you know, crops, working in industry, making uniforms for the soldiers and airplane parts and fixing trains. And they would send out these stories to the newspapers so that, you know, everyone knew what women were doing for the war effort. And there's an underlying argument here, which is, you know, we are showing our patriotism by supporting our nation during a time of war, and therefore we deserve the right to vote.
Why? In this documentary, there is a talk about it being a states' rights issue versus a federal amendment when we're talking about allowing women the right to vote. What was the main argument for why it should be a states' rights issue? Because ultimately, of course, it became a federal amendment. We know this.
Yes, we do know the end of the story. So I think, you know, most Americans believe that the Constitution guarantees us a right to vote, which it does not. The Constitution, in its original form, said nothing about the right to vote. It left the vote and determining eligibility for the polls to the states. So it was, from the beginning, a states' rights issue. That fact gets further amplified after Reconstruction when, you know, Southern states roll back the gains made during Reconstruction, and they start to impose Jim Crow. And part of this is an effort to keep Black men from the polls. So within the movement, there's disagreement over whether it's more appropriate and more proper to approach the question of women's suffrage on a state-by-state level, which is to say petitioning state legislatures for changes to the state constitution, or whether it's better and quicker and more efficient to press for an amendment to the federal constitution. And ultimately, because of, in particular, the recalcitrance of the Southern states, they didn't want Black men to vote, so they certainly weren't going to open the polls to women, because that would open the polls to Black women and thereby reopen the question of Black men voting. So the Southern states were, you know, by and large, the former states of the Confederacy were by and large against women's suffrage. And given that, I think, you know, by the 19-teens, most suffrage leaders saw the writing on the wall and saw that they were never going to get, women nationally would never get the right to vote if they pursued it state by state. And they all kind of coalesced around the idea of a federal amendment and pressed for that in tandem, if not together.
We've mentioned the word opposition, battle, fight. Obviously, this was a major ordeal. And an expansion of democracy, an expansion of rights is always met with that sort of fierce opposition and that sort of underlying fear that those in power are afraid that they're going to be treated the way that they have treated other people. So as a filmmaker, as an educated, liberated woman who enjoys all the rights of a you know, 21st century woman, how do you stop and think about your own relationship with power? And does it change after you make a film like this?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think one of the biggest takeaways for me as a filmmaker, having worked on this project, is a kind of new understanding, a greater understanding of the dynamics of social change and just how long change takes. And so, you know, when this project first came up, it was right after Me Too kind of began to crest. And we were having lots of conversations in the office around Me Too and those issues. And there were some young women in my office who were sort of expressing surprise that all this was happening at such a late date, you know, well after women had gained the right to an education, for example, or the right to own property or conduct themselves as they see fit, work in the public sphere. And I, being a generation older, you know, was reminding them that when I was born, my mother could not get a line of credit unless her husband or her father co-signed the loan. So, and this is, now keep in mind, you know, more than a century and a quarter after women started demanding equal pay for equal work, which we still haven't achieved. So it's incremental. It's really incremental. And that's very frustrating, but it also, I think, you know, there's an inspirational story in the fight for the vote because, you know, although it's painfully slow, social change can happen. It is possible.
So 100 years from now, the 2120 version of Michelle Ferrari is making a documentary about social change. What's she looking at?
Oh, my. Oh, I would like to think it's about how we stepped up to the challenge of climate change.
Michelle, thank you for your time today.
Oh, you're so welcome.
That was a filmmaker, Michelle Ferrari, who directed The Vote for American Experience. The two-part series airs Monday and Tuesday, July 6th and 7th at 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain. There are also several web-only specials at pbs.org and search American Experience. Coming up next, when we celebrate a nation, we are celebrating its people. The Transmission Times examines how this nation is coming together during a pandemic.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The Transmission Times provides a weekly snapshot of what life is like all over the USA and the world during the COVID-19 pandemic through the voices of people themselves. Listeners will recognize aspects of their own pandemic experience and maybe hear sides they hadn't thought about, with host and producer Katie Semro.
This is the Transmission Times.
Our family is surviving on our savings, which I'm really, really grateful that we went into this time with some savings. But honestly, mostly we're surviving on the generosity of others right now. And it's this very weird thing about this time that on the one hand, it feels some days excruciatingly hard, and then other days like so beautiful. The generosity and kindness and the care of people, not just who know us, but strangers even who've reached out sometimes. So that has been incredible, and it's made me really question a lot of the things that we prioritize before. I mean, I think we all know, we've all been told that money doesn't buy happiness. But it's very strange to actually be in this situation where money is the thing that is not in a large supply here. And I felt more contented and happier during this time than I have in a really, really long time.
Sometimes I find myself really grateful for the changes that this crisis has enforced, you know, the reflection on what really matters and the time with my children that I'm now having every single day. And then other times the enormity of it all hits me and I'm just there weeping and thinking, how long is this going to go on for and what will life look like afterwards?
I just feel like our life maybe needed to have the rug pulled out from underneath us, and we're being forced to reimagine everything right now. All the things that we thought were non-negotiables suddenly are up for discussion, and it's terrifying. And yet, there have been a lot of other moments where it's incredibly freeing to give ourselves permission to just kind of start over.
I don't think I do think about the future at the moment. The pandemic has really made me live in the moment much more. I think because really for the first time in my life, I haven't taken it for granted that there is a future. I work in a hospital and I was coming into contact every day that I was at work with the virus, and so seeing the effects and knowing or feeling that I was very vulnerable to that, I think I just shut down on the future a bit really and started just appreciating each day. I just don't really feel ready to start unpicking what the future's going to look like. It feels so uncertain.
I just got my master's in ESL, teaching ESL to adults, and I'm thinking about our classroom experience coming up this fall. Not knowing whether we're going back into the classroom or being online. It's a lot to think about, not having those ball tosses and relay races and close pair work and group projects. So I don't know what I see for the future, but I do know that I need my imagination and I need help. I pray for the sensitivity that I'll need in that time, whether we're online or in the classroom.
When I'm an old woman, and perhaps a grandmother, will I be regaling my grandchildren with stories of life before the pandemic? Tell us again about what it was like before, Grandma. You know, what it was like when people got to meet up in big groups. What it was like when there were huge gatherings and parties and you could hug anyone. Is that what it's gonna be? It almost feels like maybe. And you know, I don't think I did enough of that. I didn't go to enough gatherings. I didn't go to enough parties. I didn't give enough hugs. I won't have that many stories.
We had a social distancing outside party. No masks, but no shared food. The only thing we did was sit on the host chairs. And in our neighborhood, it's very woodsy and houses are separated out. So it was pee in the woods. And we gathered together without our usual hugging. But it was wonderful to see my neighbors and be able to chat with each other and find out what was happening and hear the news, good and bad.
I'm definitely not showering as often, and I am definitely not washing my hair as often, because it doesn't matter. I live in DC, and I feel like if I worked for the water company, I would not be surprised if the water usage in this area has gone down as a result of the pandemic, because I imagine that I'm not the only one who's not showering very often.
I trust my stylist, but I don't trust COVID-19. So I'm going to pretend that people can't go back to the hairdresser now, and I'm going to grow out my hair all the way, see what I think, and I can cut it off if I want to. But so far, I feel like I'm coming back into a more youthful self.
A worker had to come and do something at our apartment, and I upfront told him, hey, please bring a mask, we'll be also wearing one. And I came to that conclusion that it's easier to do it like that because we had another worker come in a few days earlier and he didn't have a mask, and I offered one to him and he said, no, he's healthy and he doesn't have anything.
There's been so many arguments online about masks, and I see memes about, I'm wearing a mask for you, or can't you wear a mask to be compassionate? And then I see the opposite of that. I see memes about not silencing yourself or covering up your face or things like that. And then on friends' posts, I read conversations about people having somebody come and yell at them in the store because they're not wearing a mask, or people getting yelled at because they are wearing a mask. And I finally just made this post and I said, you know, we're focusing on each other and making each other enemies over things like wearing a mask. And we should stop pointing at each other and turn shoulder to shoulder and point at Washington and demand to know what they're doing. Because we have to stand together. This is the old united we stand, divided we fall thing.
Parenting has not been super easy or natural for me. I think a lot of my depression in the last 8 years has come from feeling largely unfulfilled as a parent. But when I look at this time, we're suddenly on day one of shelter in place. I started this daily podcast. It's 6 days a week. It's called Shelter in Place. And my husband took over the primary caregiver role instantly. Like, we just swapped roles on day one. And so for the first time in a long time, I feel deeply fulfilled in life.
The lockdown has sent our poor daughter completely loopy. We think she's on the autistic spectrum, and school was really important for her, a really big anchor in her life. We used to do this thing at the dinner table where everyone would say one good thing that had happened to them during the day, and every time it came to her, she always said school.
Our school started back today, so my eldest went back to school for the first time. He was sad and he didn't want to go in. He said he wanted to stay with me, but I managed to persuade him in with the help of his teacher, who he did know already. And then he was in his little bubble. His class is called Hubble, so he's in a Hubble bubble of about 7 children. And they had a really good morning, so that was lovely. And he came back all happy, covered in chocolate from his biscuit from lunchtime.
Whenever we've been out walking, she's always been very anxious that we get way off the trail when other people are coming by a long way. And then she said, was that 6 feet, Daddy? Was that 6 feet, Daddy? And, you know, it was probably more like 20 feet. We've been able to live with it, but just recently her anxiety around food and taking medicines and things has become extreme. She'll reject food if something that we can't even see has happened to it, like her finger has touched the outside of a bowl that contains rice, for example. She won't eat it. She won't eat the rice. She sees meat in the pan and she thinks a part of the meat looks green, which obviously it doesn't, and then she won't eat the meat.
My daughter has developed an obsession with making dens, and those dens are her safe spaces that she goes to when she's upset and when she doesn't know how to handle things. And my son has become obsessed with cars and reading magazines about cars. And that's his little escape from everything that's going on.
I didn't really question that the lockdown was necessary and was, on balance, a good thing. And I am not at all convinced anymore that the gains in terms of not overloading medical systems and that kind of thing are worth the pains that, if I watched the news, I assume I wouldn't see on the news, really. You don't necessarily see this kind of stress, this kind of distress, unless you live in it, and then you can't get away from it. And I don't personally... I don't know. I'd like to say it's not worth it. I guess it's hypothetical because we don't know what would have happened if the virus had been allowed to run its course freely. But my heart says this ain't worth it. My heart says stop.
I'd like to say a huge thank you to Karen, Gemma, Rini, Brian, Catherine, Christina, Diane, and three different Lauras, whose voices are coming to you from Washington, D.C., California, Maine, New York, Arizona, Romania, and the U.K. The Transmission Times Project is collecting audio diaries from people like you during this pandemic so that we can create an archive to document this moment in history. If you'd like to join the Transmission Times and add your voice and your story to the archive and possibly be on the podcast, we'd love to have you. Please sign up at transmissiontimes.org/join. That's transmissiontimes.org/join. I'm Katie Semrow. This is the Transmission Times.
The Transmission Times is produced in Southern Maine by Katie Semrow. Dakota Datebook is next.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street, in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 3rd. On this date, in 1919, the Hope Pioneer announced that the Equity Packing Plant had begun operations in West Fargo. John Haggart was the driving force behind the cooperative. He was born in 1846 in New York State, where his father owned a farm. After serving in the Army, Haggart relocated to Dakota Territory and made one of the first land claims in the Red River Valley. He was a prosperous wheat farmer, and the area was first named Haggart, but is now known as West Fargo. John Haggart was well known in the area. He was the first man in the state to become a Mason. He was instrumental in forming the Fargo Southern Railroad. The 600 residents of Fargo elected him town marshal in 1875 when the city was first incorporated. He was also the first sheriff of Cass County, and he even served as fire chief and deputy U.S. marshal. In 1889, Haggart was elected to the first state senate, and he introduced the first bill, which authorized an appropriation for the North Dakota Agricultural College. He also helped ensure that the college would be in Fargo. It was in 1916 that ranchers organized by Haggart established the Cooperative Meat Packing Plant. It took 3 years for the Equity Cooperative Packing Company to be built and begin operating. The company also built 24 houses for workers east of the Cheyenne River and north of Main Street. Spurred by the plant, the community saw the establishment of a hotel, general store, restaurant, and post office. However, the plant was not a cooperative for long. After only a few years, the company declared bankruptcy, and the doors were shuttered in 1922. In 1925, Armour and Company bought it and resumed operations. Henry Ford gets credited for inventing the assembly line, but Ford himself gave credit to the meat packing industry. Armour's competitive edge was the assembly line. Armour also bragged it used, quote, every part of the animal except the squeal, unquote. In addition to food products, Armour produced adhesives, fertilizer, and soap. The industry was so central to the community that the West Fargo High School athletic team's nickname became the Packers. But the meatpacking era ended when the Armour plant closed in 1960. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I hope that the listeners on Prairie Public tune into the Thomas Jefferson Hour, because I believe that we need to lift the idea of civilization and civility and culture, that we need, in a sense, to rise to the occasion of being what Jefferson had in mind for this civilization, and that the only way to do that is to be self-conscious about it and to work together to create the conditions under which we know we would be happier, more fulfilled, and more enlightened. And I think that the Jefferson Hour, in the broad world of public radio, is an important niche in which that project finds voice and creates a community of people who want to live in a more enlightened world than the one we happen to be born into.
Join Clay Jenkinson for the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Sundays at 11 a.m. Central, 10 a.m. Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Thank you so much for listening, and have a safe and happy Independence Day.